I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS.
I was playing with this crazy accordion player at a hotel, and all of a sudden Nico starts going into labor. And I said, oh my God, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I have a gig tonight. So Marianne says, well, can't you get a sub? And I said, wait a minute, you're right. My friend Jim Markway did Lamaze.
He was gonna get a sub for my Bert.
And they both looked at me waiting for me to laugh. And I'm like,
it wasn't a joke.
So I'll never live that down.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. Today we are featuring our second conversation with side musicians. We recently had violinist and string arranger Rob Moose on here, and we're continuing to expand by having not one but two side musicians on this, and not just any side musicians, but a father-daughter duo in Cranston and Annie Clements. Cranston is a guitarist from New Orleans who has played with everybody in New Orleans royalty, from Dr. John and Alan Toussaint to Irma Thomas and Maria Mulder and Stanton Moore, to everybody. And his daughter, Annie, who they like to say he needed a bass player, so he just made one from scratch, is a bass player who has played with everybody from Sugarland and Maren Morris to Hootie and the Blowfish, Mary Chapin Carpenter, and Amos Lee. And what a talented family.
Also hilarious. We've had some really entertaining, funny people on this podcast, but I don't think I've laughed as hard as this hour.
Yeah.
They're incredible storytellers about what it is to just have a lineage of musicians in your family as your livelihood, as your way of life. It's not a question of making it, but this is just what we do. As well as the sanctity of little rooms of making music in small spaces, and the reality of being a side musician as a parent and some of the structural change that really needs to happen.
Yeah. So I usually say, please enjoy, but you will enjoy. Buckle up. Here is our conversation with Cranston and Annie Clements.
We always like to start the conversations with a how are you? And that's a how are you really? Not a small talk, how are you? And where are you physically and creatively?
Wow.
I lost my gloves.
Very upset about it.
I was going to say, our four-year-old lost her glove at the zoo like 2 years ago, and she still talks about it. So you two would have something to talk about.
Luckily, I'll be able to write songs about it.
That's one thing that's awesome about Crandad, is he relates to children so well. So just to sort of start with, how are we? Where are we? What's going on? We are in Big Sky, Montana, in my home. We just finally purchased a home here in November after several years of living here in like a rented condo with rented furniture as we went back and forth between Nashville and Big Sky. And my God, it's like, oh, we're finally home, like with our stuff and our So it's been, you know, a lot of work to put the house together and to get unpacked. And we're still unpacking and doing all of that. But I couldn't be better. professionally, family, all of that stuff. And it just so happened that Dad was up here this week visiting us and the grandkids and seeing our new house for the first time. So he's up from New Orleans. But how are you doing?
The good news is all the work was done before I got here.
Yeah.
That's huge.
I know.
Yeah.
My dad also is very handy with, you know, carpentry projects. So I think he was probably expecting an onslaught.
I have some ideas.
Some improvements. But yeah, but we're great. We went this morning and we have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. And what's really cool about where we live is that all of the schools during the ski season, they have a program that is free for all the children. You get a free lift ticket if you're a child enrolled in school. They have free ski rental gear that you can get if you need that. And one day a week for 6 weeks, everybody goes skiing for a whole day. You just don't go to school. The whole class goes to the mountain and you ski. And that checks the box for the PE requirement. For like,
oh my God, amazing.
You know, and of course they have recess and they have outside time every day, but that program is just now coming to an end. This was their last day of ski. So we went to drop them off and Crandad got to walk on the slopes and I got a video and he's just like, where am I? From New Orleans to Big Sky. It's very drastic. But yeah, so now we have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old who are both terrific skiers. And that's just part of the culture here. Everyone has to learn to do it. Everyone but me.
I'm out.
So from that perspective, it's ideal. We're living in this small town. We can walk to school if we want. It's a little bit of a hike. A bike ride would be better. And the kids get to ski every week, sometimes twice a week. It's just small town living. I think there's around 3,000 full-time residents here. And then, of course, the ebbs and flows of tourism. But yeah, it's just such a joy to have a family here. And there's a give and take with the closest Target. And Costco is an hour away. That's all in Bozeman. But I'm raising my kids in a place where you walk down the street and there's no McDonald's. There's no any of that. It's all just family-owned and operated businesses. And it's pretty damn cool.
Amazing.
Amazing, especially for a touristy town.
Oh, totally. Oh, no, no, no. There's one chain store called Faraday, which is actually a great business. When I played the Newport Folk Fest in, this was 23, they had like a pop-up backstage and they were giving away all this great gear. Like, so they're super into like the musician community. Like, that's like the one person here who has a store with a name that you would maybe recognize. So, but
never heard of it.
I don't know if they make gloves. I think they're more like warmer weather
like
clothes.
Alpine sweaters.
Oh,
stuff.
Okay. No gloves.
No gloves. Sorry.
Well, you mentioned fast foods. Where I live in New Orleans, there's a McDonald's a block and a half away from us. And I moved in 2003 and I've never been in it.
Wow.
Proud to say.
That's pretty cool. You've also got a good snowball stand right around
yes,
the corner.
We do.
Thank God.
What part of New Orleans do you live in?
I ended up on the what we call the West Bank. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you all have ever been
so
to
it's
New
on
Orleans.
The other side of the Mississippi.
Across the river. It's, you got to fight the bridge. And it's been since 2003, but I grew up in what they call Uptown. It was quite amazing. I remember my mom would always bring us out of the house to the street when they'd have these jazz funerals with these jazz marching bands that I was listening to since I was 5 years old, just down the street, Dijon's Olympia Brass Band or whatever. And so we got an education in the New Orleans traditional jazz music starting early. And our mom was a huge music lover, so that helped a lot. You take it for granted, but when I think about it at this point in my life, how fortunate I was to grow up in New Orleans.
That's right.
And New Orleans is, I mean, I've been a lot of different places. And let's leave Nashville out because Nashville's its own very cool scene. But a lot of places, it seems like it's not as communal. Like people are like fighting each other for gigs and stuff. New Orleans, like, hey, man, can you cover me Friday night? Yeah, I got you. You know, it's more of a family feeling, and it's not fake or contrived, just the way it is.
Well, and we were talking even last night. We were having a glass of wine in the kitchen and just
the one?
Yeah. We're having several glasses of wine in the kitchen and catching up and talking about those gigs where you just get a call and you don't know who's going to be there. And you're just delighted when the rest of the band shows up like, oh, you're here too. This is great.
Right.
Like,
right.
And then you just make music. Go.
And then there's the classic line. We'd like to introduce the band now. Cranston, this is Mike. I think we played together five, you know.
I love that.
That type of thing, which happens all the time.
I know it.
Yeah, didn't we play when that riverboat sang?
No. And terrible. You lost your gloves.
Oh, my gloves disappeared horrible. Again.
From the outside looking in and from friends that I know who live in New Orleans, it feels like a community culture where music and being a musician is a deeper part of life, where somewhere like Nashville, we've been here 12 years, and Nashville is like a place people come to be musicians because of the business and the industry, but it doesn't feel like the culture.
Exactly.
In like a spiritual, soulful sense to me.
You really hit the nail on the head. And growing up in New Orleans, what you do have is you have all these musical families that have lived there for generations. And it's just a part of the culture and the fabric of the culture. So like, you know, me and dad, my dad's father, Louis Clements, he had a big band. He had his own orchestra. And dad grew up doing it. And he taught me and my brothers to do it. And so it's organic. And I often say, you know, my dad needed a bass player. So he made one from scratch. And so it wasn't anything like, I'm going to make it. I'm going to do whatever. It was just, well, this is what we're doing. And here you go.
And I was not trying to force my kids to become musicians by any means. They were around it constantly. And your mom is very musical and played piano and stuff. And my son's mom's excellent piano player.
She's also a professional musician.
So kind of the whole culture. And our mom played piano every night at home, and she had incredible taste. And we'd hear all these songs. Me and my brother trying to go to sleep, and she'd finish a song. We'd say, run to the top of the fifth. What was that called? That was Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. Okay. What was that song? That was It Could Happen to You. Oh, you know, I'd be in tears. You know, these songs would just knock me out. It's just from childbirth, really.
Yeah.
My perception of New Orleans, and I guess relating it to Nashville, and I wonder if this will come across, but like in Nashville, it seems like the musicians are on stage and the stage is really tall. And in New Orleans, it feels like the musicians are just there.
And there
is no stage. Yeah. It's like there's no separation between the audience and the musicians.
Well, and Dad just said it. You got these brilliant jazz brass bands just walking down the street playing music. Mm-hmm. Like they're in your neighborhood.
Right.
Like, they're out on stage. Mm-hmm. They're walking past your house. Like,
yeah.
And it is like that. And that is really what we're trying to build here in Big Sky. And we're in a really privileged position to bring that community feel to this community. And it's been really interesting, having lived in Nashville for almost 20 years, and now to be here and to see the differences between music as a commodity or like a tourist hook versus what happens here, where people just want music. They want it wherever they go. And there's all these opportunities. There's this thing here called après-ski, which I've had to learn all of this. And I've learned so much about the hospitality industry since I've lived here. It's really interesting. But basically, so what happens is people come here, they ski all day, and then they want to stop and basically have cocktails at like 3 o'clock and then go to dinner and then do whatever. But all of those events, they want music. They want somebody sitting there playing a guitar and singing and doing that. And so my husband is actually, his job now is to book most of the restaurants and resorts around here with that music. And he has installed stages in all of these rooms. But when I say stage, you know, it's a platform that's less than a foot off the ground. So you still have that connection and that intimacy. And it's just a part of life here. It's something that people have come to expect when they come here. If they go to a restaurant or they go to a bar, like there should be somebody sitting there playing music because that's what strikes people and what they want. So It's been really great to bring together this whole community in the surrounding areas. Just like you were saying in New Orleans, it's like I was sick for the past 2 weeks. So we were having to call in favors and have people come in and cover the gigs. And we have a network of people who are getting them all kinds of really great work. And I say we, Sad, my husband is doing everything. I do nothing. I just enjoy
my life. Sure, it's not entirely true.
It's mostly true. But you can ask him. he will corroborate.
Oh, yeah.
But he is really working to build that community. And it's interesting because I think in Nashville, people kind of like fighting for gigs and it's very competitive and everyone is doing this thing with the hope of getting out. And we were having the conversation last night where it's like, this is it. We've arrived. And I have so many people who will come up to us after hearing. I have a project called the Tuesday Night Rodeo Club, and it's myself and my husband and a great fourth generation Montana artist named Amanda Stewart. And we play Mondays and Tuesday nights. People will come up and be like, not to sound conceited, they're like, you guys are so great. What are you doing here? Like, don't you want to be playing on, like you said, these big stages that are 10 feet off the ground? And it's like, I've done that for so long. And I love that. And there's a joy and a beauty in that. But being able to do a 2-hour show from start to finish with no set list and all you're doing is interfacing with people and bringing so much joy to them because they are getting a say in it. They are part of the show. They're part of the experience. We're just on the floor. I'll send you guys some footage of, and the place is just mobbed and people are standing on stools and it's wild.
It was remarkable, I have to say.
Dad came and sat in with us on Tuesday. It's just a totally different way to offer the gift of music and really get a real connection that means something and matters. That's why we do this, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
that's why we do this. I can't speak for everybody. But.
And it's hard to pinpoint why some people become musicians, you know, but there has to be some point in your life where music does something for you, that reaches you at a level that gives you the determination to get over all the hurdles. Because my God, I mean, I had been playing piano at a very young age and got into the school band, started with clarinet and ended up on French horn. Then the Beatles showed up, if you ever heard of them. And all of a sudden, and we had a guitar, we had inherited my mom's dad's guitar, our granddad's archtop, 1904 Washburn.
Where is that?
We still have it.
You do?
Yes.
That's what Ross was talking about, your cousin.
Yes, we do have it.
Thank God.
And so all of a sudden the Beatles appear and I'm like, wait a minute, this French horn is kind of okay, but what about this guitar? I mean, I was like on fire from the Beatles and I picked up the guitar and I thought, this is going to be fun. Wrong. It's like, I might as well have picked up a railroad tie. It's like, what am I going to do now? First of all, I started thinking, none of the notes, there's no reference points. No. Like, I know the scales, I know key signatures. So for about 3 weeks, I was wrestling with trying to understand how do these notes relate. And all of a sudden, I realized all the notes are on the guitar. They're just not screaming their names at you. Then you start thinking, why does my finger hurt so much? And then you get your chord book out and they want you to play an F chord. Well, you got to cover two strings with one finger.
It's an outrage.
So the agony, but nothing's going to stop me because I was motivated.
But that's the difference.
A lot of people, everyone. Well, look, I've done a lot of teaching over the years and I can tell you right away, when a student walks in, whether they have the magic, the desire, fire. Or whether it's like a cool thing to do. I mean, I want to play guitar. It's like, well, it's way more to it than it's just kind of cool. Yeah. You know, I mean, it has to be everything. Playing guitar became my entire life. Well, it still is. I just never got tired of it. We're not going to talk about the 60s much, are we?
Talk about whatever. You guys want to ask us some questions because we'll talk the 60s for the next hour.
Maybe we'll get back to the 60s.
This is a show. I'm really enjoying this.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
I also feel like what you were just saying needs to be like an advertisement against AI.
It takes work.
It takes work. I teach music. I've been a music teacher my entire adult life. Whenever students will complain about their fingers hurting and asking, like, what can I do? And I'm like, you just suffer through it.
You just play.
It will get easier, but like, there's no way around it. It's only through it. Yep. And they're like, what?
And then you can't stop.
Stop crying.
Because if you stop and then try to start again, it'll
hurt
again.
That's so the other thing. It's like
you
have to
keep going and don't stop.
Yes. The more you stop, the more it's going to hurt.
Yes, that is a fact. My line to guitar students who are beginning, I said, look, you're not going to have any fun at all for about 3 weeks. And then you'll suddenly have a little fun. And then you'll have more fun. But it's that first mountain that most people can't get through. They can't get over it. They give
what's
up.
What's interesting, too, that I'm encountering now is I also teach just a small handful of students, and I have over the years. But with YouTube, these kids will come in and they'll show me, like, I learned to play this. But because they watch someone and the person, like a monkey pushing buttons, like put your hand here, put your hand here, with no concept of the work that you're talking about, where you unlocked why
exactly
the scale exists. And so then if you learn in that way, you can't do anything with it other than play that one song by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been so interesting. And I try to deconstruct this with my students where I sit there, I always have a piano ready. And I use the piano while they're playing guitar or bass, whatever they're doing, to show them, here's what's happening and here's why it's happening.
Yeah.
That is very, very important.
Well, and I think with this podcast and with everything that you guys are talking about, and I should confess to you, I actually came up with the title. I think I called it The Other 23 Hours about 10 years ago. Because I have always been so much more interested in the mechanics of life on the road. And I've really built a career on sharing that side of things with fans. Because they're much more interested in, like, guys, I ate pancakes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner today. Than, like, here's my blah, blah, blah take on blah, blah, blah. You know, they want to know how you're living and how you're surviving. And it's that same question of the why. You know, why would you put yourself into a situation where you're living on a bus with 12 bunks with total strangers that you now have as intimate a relationship with, short of physical intimacy, than you have with your own spouse?
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to make it work.
And then you sometimes ended up getting on the wrong bus and you still made it known.
Well, I mean, there's so many nights where I'd be, you know, on the road with Maren. I did two pregnancies on a tour with Maren. And my first one, I was very sick. Nora, I was morning sick for the first 18 weeks. Ugh. And that's how I actually ended up confessing to them that I was pregnant, because I was throwing up on the bus. And I finally had to
target
tell them.
Vomiting all over the walls.
I mean, I was. And I had to tell them, like, you're not going to catch this. I don't think. I am pregnant. But I'd be sitting up there in the middle of the night, nauseous and just holding on for dear life in the front lounge. And one of the guitar players would just come wandering out at 3 a.m, hair disheveled, no shirt, in boxer briefs or whatever, and go take a leak. And I'm just sitting there being pregnant. It's like not really a whole lot of difference between what's happening here than what happens in my own household. And that creates its own set of challenges and makes this business so unique. You don't go home at 5 o'clock at night and just leave all that behind.
Yeah.
You're giving everything, your entire body and soul, to this enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you guys had sort of asked me about the differences between being a side man. I always say side man because I'm just so used to saying that, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm a woman. But, you know, a side person and the artist and having kids. And so just kind of open that door. I don't have the option like the artist does to say, I'm bringing my family.
Yeah.
You know, I had kids. Isn't that exciting?
Worse yet, I'm bringing my dad.
I have done that. brought my dad on.
We have done that.
We have done that. But yeah, there's a lot of advocacy work around trying to get women onto these big 10-foot stages. But the fact that it is a woman's sole responsibility to grow and carry a child and then literally nurse the child off of your own body, it's just a non-starter for somebody in my position who is just completely at the mercy of whatever artist I'm working for. There's no rules. There's no HR. There's no anything. And that's across the board for anything you're trying to do as a side man, not just having a family, but it becomes basically an impossibility. And so the work that I'm doing now is there's been a documentary team following me for several years and just documenting my journey of motherhood through the lens of being a side person and what the industry can sort of collectively do to change some of this, to at least make it a little bit easier. It does have to start at the big stages because there's just not the infrastructure in these smaller venues. For instance, when I went back on the road with Sugarland at the end of 2024, Jennifer, who I have a phenomenal relationship with, invited me and Sad, my husband, to ride her bus and to bring our kids, to bring our two kids.
Incredible.
And she brought her son. But a big roadblock to having a family on the road is just, there's just no space. Mm-hmm. You got a bus that has at most 12 bunks, which is nobody likes that. And if you space them out, you can maybe get a condo situation with 8 bunks. That's a little more humane. But in this case, there wasn't enough bunk space for me to bring a caretaker and our two kids. So what I ended up doing was sourcing childcare in every city, a different person in every city on an 18-stop tour. And I went to the venue managers and I said, hey, I'm Annie Clemency now. You might have seen me running around with these kids. I'm here now. I managed to find somebody to keep an eye on during soundcheck in the show, which is the only time I'm not available. Mm-hmm. I'm available for the other 23 hours.
Yeah.
And next time I come through, could you help me and find a nanny, just like y'all find a rock doc and a massage therapist and a chiropractor and all these people that you use regularly that are safe to be backstage and they are cool around a famous person or whatever. They're not weird. Yep. And it's been very interesting because most of the men I spoke with immediately said, oh, no one's ever asked me that before.
Yeah.
And then all of the women said, you're absolutely right. This is a huge roadblock to getting women on stage. This should have been figured out years ago. We don't know how to figure it out. But if you have any ideas, you know, let's keep in touch. Mm-hmm. And I do have a lot of ideas. And this documentary has a lot of ideas. And so I'm hopeful that we can really get something going where there is a caretaker who's been vetted, who's trusted, and just a small space backstage. I'm talking about basketball arenas and hockey arenas, which is largely where I performed, and sheds. Let's figure this out. There's got to be a way. Because then in that instance, if you don't have to bring a caretaker who's taking up space in the bunk and you have somebody that you can trust at each show to watch your kid during an hour-long sound check and a 90-minute show in a safe spot backstage, men can bring their kids. You know, you can bring your 5-year-old. He can sleep in your bunk with you. You know, it's not super comfy, but at least you could take the load off of your partner. It doesn't have to just be about women. It's just a healthier way that we could be doing things out here.
It's just our belief systems, because we believe so deeply that it's women's responsibility. So there's never any inquiry. I haven't ever looked into the statistics, but I would assume that 95% of the top male touring acts and bands and members have families. But they're at home.
Especially in Nashville, especially in country music. And if you want to be the genre of family values, put your money where your mouth is.
But it's just, I mean, we believe that physical care or catering is all like essential, vital parts of the budget and the production. So why don't we think childcare? It's because it's so deeply believed still that children belong at the home with the mothers. And on every level, I think you're right, because it's such a pervasive issue. You know, I play tiny little clubs. We have two children. And my experience, I've talked about this endlessly on this podcast, and what I care about is because When I told my booking agent that I was pregnant, he had a terrible response. He literally, the first thing he said was, well, there goes the whole summer. And my booking agent was a very high up, like, books some of the biggest acts in music, my heroes. So it was also, I was like the beginning of my relationship with him, the beginning of my career starting to happen. And it felt like I got punched in the gut. And he was just like, oh, Michaela, this is going to be so hard. You're not on a bus. How are you going to do this? I would be worried about you. That's what he said. And I didn't know what to say. I was like holding back tears. And then I wrote an email telling him, like reaffirming, this has always been my plan. We're okay. Just book the shows. And I never got a response. And I got a very 180 in his treatment of me until it came to a head and we parted ways.
Good but Lord.
That's outrageous. Let me just say that that's horrific. It's outrageous. Unbelievable.
I get the same thing, a 180, when they hear some of my song titles.
But not allowed to share them. The children are home.
Oh, yes.
Well, I mean, I want the documentary to open with a statement of when the drummer comes and tells the band that his wife is pregnant, everyone toasts to him and gives him a big clap on the back. If a woman who's in the band comes and says, I'm pregnant, they get the response that your booking agent gave you, which was like, well, there goes your career.
Totally. And I talk about this all the time. And sometimes I'll think, you know, there are so many more examples out there now of mothers as front people, as well as side musicians. So sometimes I'll get self-conscious. The agent that I worked with, he still books some women who also are mothers. So I'm like, well, maybe it was just me. Maybe I just wasn't good enough. And I'll think all these things and I'll think, well, maybe it's just a me problem. And like, it's not an issue for everybody. And then I'll get a text from a woman who's has a new baby, and she's like, God, I just got up for this 7-week bus tour and I made the mistake of asking if there were any accommodations for my child. And then they told me, never mind, I didn't get the offer.
I mean, that's grounds for a lawsuit.
I know. And I'll see an artist post on Instagram that they're announced their pregnancy and literally say, music industry, please don't write me off. And I'm like, no, just because not every single woman has the same experience and some do luck out with a supportive team around them at the time does not mean that this is a personal issue. This is a systemic issue.
Our experiences couldn't have been more opposite. Like,
yeah.
As this was happening to you with your booking agent, like, I was doing more sideman stuff at the time, but people would be like, hey, I know you have a kid on the way. Like, is this budget okay? Like, is this going to be enough? Like, I got more respect. And it's like, it was a stark contrast.
That is remarkable.
Now that pregnancy, that child is almost 5. And now we have a second child. And I just got a new booking agent. Literally haven't had a booking agent for years. And I'm like, how did I go from having one of the top agents to like feeling like a leper? And I'm like, it has to be because the assumption is I'm not a worthy investment because I have so many children too. But I have gone the other way. And now motherhood and my children are in my songs, in my album cover is me nursing. Like, I'm so far the other way that I'm just like, fuck all of you guys. I'm putting it in your face because motherhood is not a liability. But I also then talk to a lot of side musicians who feel even more like there's no agency of like, how do you do this? So I care a lot about the work that you're doing because I don't think the solution is just, well, this is just made for men and the women who are willing to sacrifice what they need to sacrifice to be in the boys' club and keep your families hidden away. Don't talk about it.
I self-funded IVF starting in my mid-30s, basically just to give myself the opportunity, knowing the mountain that I was up against with how am I going to have a kid on tour? And things were going so well for me from a career perspective. It's like, if I have a kid now, I'm just throwing this lifetime away. But I really want to have a kid. And I've been very clear about that since I was 20 years old. And in fact, I brought a prop. Hang on.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. So many years ago, my first like big tour was Sugar Land. The Times-Picayune magazine or newspaper in New Orleans did this huge article. Putting it in my dad's face.
I'm here.
But the last, and I was 26 when this article was written. The last sentence, which you can't see, but I will read to you. In a short time, Annie Clements has traveled a long way from her days as a struggling New Orleans musician, but her overall ambitions remain the same. And here's a quote from me. What I would like to do is put 3 children through college being a musician, she said. That is the ultimate goal.
Love that.
I got chills.
I did too.
I'm going to do it on two. I'm not going to go for the three, but I will do that. That's mm-hmm. the trajectory that I am on. But I did the IVF to set myself up to have kids when it made sense for my career, and it worked out.
Now, this may add some flavor. What's an IDF?
IVF.
Oh, IVF. Oh. Okay. Like, I thought an IDF was some kind of fund. Okay. No, I know the IDF. I know. Oh, Lord.
Oh, my God. This is my favorite part.
With my daughter, Nora, we transferred her embryo. We had the Beatles going. I was in the bed, and they let you pick out music.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Yeah, so she went into the Beatles and came out to the Beatles.
Absolutely.
We had a playlist going when she was being born, and Thad had put on, like, you know, Beatles number ones. And, like, the songs were going, and she was about to come out to Eleanor Rigby. And I was like, no, I don't want that. Get up. And then it was like Penny Lane, like, okay, fine. She came out to Penny Lane, so that's her song. And then our son, Hawk, I think he was born to If I Needed Someone. I have to fact check that, but we did an all George Harrison
Ken
playlist because his first name is actually Harrison.
Oh, that's right. So. Of course.
I love that.
Beatles are very, very important to this family.
Makes sense.
The music, I mean, when our first daughter was born, when Georgia was born, Aaron put on a playlist and I had been like, it was a long labor and I was pushing for like 3 hours and Aaron put on Joni Mitchell. And I was like, no, this is
not motivating.
In retrospect, I was like, I realized pretty quickly. She's like, what is this? And I'm like, yeah, so I don't know. Sorry.
I was like, I am in a work, like the workout of my life right now. So then he put on Doja Cat. I think she actually was born to Joy Ladekun. But our second child, I've met Joy. And every time I'm like, I pushed my baby out while you were singing. She's like, cool.
But that's cool. She's great. Yeah. I've done several bills that she's been on. She's fantastic and has a lot of insight about this crazy industry.
Yeah,
absolutely.
When our son was born, it was Bad Bunny the whole time, and that was
no way.
The whole delivery room was a dance party. Like Michaela would push, and everybody would be like there and present, and then she'd relax for a second, and everybody would kind of dance for a while, and then it was bad. You know,
yeah, it was very fun. Joyful.
I went with Motorhead.
No. That's what Thad would have chosen.
Right.
That's his line.
No.
So I'm curious how it was for each of you, Cranston, being a father and being a musician, and how much you were on the road while you were raising your kids and what that dynamic was like. And then also from Annie's perspective of having a parent who's a musician.
I have a good horror story. This was when my twins were born. In all honesty, I have not been a road warrior. I've been all over the world doing various things, but
you were on the road quite a bit.
I was on the road.
You were on the road with Dr. John.
Yeah, I was out
with Skaggs.
Yeah.
And Maria Muldaur.
Got a lot of traveling with Maria. Mm-hmm. But at one point, the twins were maybe a year and a half just walking, and I was doing some gigs with Dr. John, and we were playing in Monterey, California. And I believe that was the timeline. And I get this call from their mom. She sent me a short film of what she woke up to. The boys had discovered the kitchen. Now, I'm out of town, so I don't have to clean this up. They took everything out of the refrigerator, everything out of the pantry, and mixed it all and painted the walls and the refrigerator.
Oh my God.
With everything you can imagine, flour, orange juice, eggs, milk.
And I do remember after that, y'all put a padlock on the fridge.
Oh, I got creative.
You put a freaking latch on it.
And Jan was just letting me know what I was missing. Because theoretically, if I hadn't been traveling, I would have been on my hands and knees for 6 hours like she ended up being. But I was just kind of, let me see if my breakfast is ready here.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely the balance. I mean, it was the same for me, too, having my kids and being gone for, you know, weeks at a time with Marin and then coming home and like, oh, great. I'm glad you guys survived. You know, where's catering? Like, what's for dinner? Like, you definitely feel a lot of guilt watching these other people pick up the slack.
Yeah, that was a tough one for me. It's like, oh, I mean, part of me was like, thank God I'm not home right now. But on the other hand, it's like, somebody has to clean this mess up.
That's bad. You know? That's bad. Well, I mean, and truthfully, the only reason that we're thriving the way that we are is because Thad's mom lives with us and has since after the pandemic when we moved out here. And that's the secret sauce. Like, that's how the sausage is made, is that I can walk out that door at all hours of the night and go work and play a show, and I don't have to worry about who's
watching. It's huge. It is huge.
We couldn't do it otherwise.
No.
You should tell the story about Lamaze.
Oh, God.
I want this on record.
Do I have to tell that
come on,
one?
Come on. I'll help. I'll set it up.
Well, this we got to get the background.
Yes.
Annie's mom decided we were going to do Lamaze. Have you ever heard of Lamaze?
Yes. The breathing. Yeah.
The breathing.
The breathing, et cetera. So we went to these Lamaze classes. They would give us these exercises that we would do at home. This is going to get slightly graphic. So I'd be sitting there by the bedside and Nico would be practicing. And then I would say, contraction begins. And I'd click the stopwatch. And she's supposed to breathe the certain way. So at one point, I'm sitting there at the side of the bed going through these Lamaze sessions. And I'm like falling asleep. I'm nodding out.
Classic.
And all of a sudden, I hear Nico's voice at high volume. Don't you understand? I'm like, what? Something this big has to come out of something this big. And then when I stayed awake. So that's not the worst part
of the
story.
Here's the worst part. So
now this is the worst part. Do you want to tell
us? Yes, please. No. So my mom is now in labor.
God.
She realizes she's going into labor. And my dad, of course, has a gig. And so now it's like, oh, crap, what are we going to do? He's got to leave.
And Mary Ann was there.
Right, my aunt was there. It's not important to the story.
It's very important. I had a gig booked that night when Nico started to go into labor. It was one of these tuxedo gigs. I was playing with this crazy accordion player at a hotel. And all of a sudden, Nico starts going into labor. And your aunt, Mary Ann, was sitting there at the bedside. And I said, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have a gig tonight. So Mary Ann says, well, can't you get a sub? And I said, wait a minute. You're right. My friend Jim Markway did Lamaze.
He was going to get a sub for my birth.
And they both looked at me waiting for me to laugh. And I'm like,
it wasn't a joke.
So I'll never live that down. And I have thought of getting a career as a stand-up comedian. And I could start with that story at any time.
That's a true story. But I do want to show you some literature. So when I got pregnant in like 2020 with Nora, my mom sent me all of her old pregnancy books. Like, these would be helpful, including Thank You, Dr. Lamaze.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Copyright 1964.
Forward by Cranston Clements.
Okay. The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding. Like, I have all of these. Like, Mom, we do have the internet. And I have doctored. I'm going to send you all of my literature on how to have a child. But yes, so.
Oh, my God.
Well.
He was going to get a sub for my birth.
I'll never live that down. But it was just, I was in such shock. And I hadn't been in the tuxedo already. Maybe.
Wait, so did
different.
You go to the gig?
You got Markway to sub your gig.
I got somebody to cover the gig.
And you came to my birth.
Of course I was there. Of course, your mom was in labor for 36 hours before they gave her the epidural. We were trying to do natural. 36 hours, she was frozen at 6 centimeters. I know some stuff. So they gave her the epidural, and then like 30 minutes later, she's at 10 centimeters.
Yeah. You Meanwhile, know? You're like, I could have gone and done the gig and been back.
I'm a practical man. Now, here's the kicker. I get to be in the room. Somehow they lifted the ban on me. Okay, you can be there when your daughter is born. Annie's born. The nurse has picked her up and swaddled her, whatever they do, fire hose and all. And then the nurse presents Annie to me, and I'm staring in Annie's eyes, and all of a sudden I'm in this tractor beam of what I realize is not a blank slate. It's pure consciousness, the highest openest form of pure energy I've ever experienced. So I'm just staring, and Annie is staring into my eyes. And I just, without even thinking, hold my hand up with my finger, and Annie reaches up and grabs my finger. It's like, okay, thank God I didn't do that gig.
Yeah.
Well, and that is the thing about all of this, and this a message that I want to send to musicians is just like having children is the best thing I've ever done. Mm-hmm. And like, Michaela, to your point, I don't want people to hear that message and think, okay, Annie is now unhirable because having children is the best thing she's ever done.
Right.
It's made me a more compassionate and more open human being, a more compassionate and more open musician. And unfortunately, what also is hard, and I did a lot of research before I made the decision to have children. I talked to every woman I could get on the phone or find who had a kid, who didn't have a kid. I talked to Mary Chapin mm-hmm. about this. I was playing mm-hmm. on a record of hers Dave Cobb was producing, and we had a lot of long talks about it. And you had people who say, boy, I regret not doing this. Mm-hmm. I had some women who said, turns out it did derail my career, and I kind of wish I hadn't done it. Mm-hmm. And then I had women who said, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And you don't know until you do it. You mm-hmm. just don't know how you react. You were ready to go to your gig. And then you looked into the eyes of pure consciousness. And, you know, it's just like, yeah, just that's the hardest part about it, is it's just a gamble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's no way to know. And just like I was saying earlier about, like, there's no rules on a tour. There's no handbook about how to be a parent, unless, of course, we're talking about the womanly art of breastfeeding, which is this copy of Thank You, Dr. Malone's costs $1.95. When the hell did this come
out? Oh, my God.
It's unbelievable. Anyway, you know, there are no rules, and everybody is trying to figure it out with very limited resources. Mm-hmm. And all I can speak to is my own experience and just being an advocate for myself, because nobody else is sure as hell going to do it for me. Mm-hmm. And I do say that I'm fortunate that I got to the level that I got before I had kids. And that mm-hmm. was by design, like with the IVF and the huge amount of that cost me a year's worth of my take home salary after taxes yep. to pay mm-hmm. for that privilege. Yep. Mm-hmm. Talk about privilege. Mm-hmm. Those are my choices. It's like, I could try to get pregnant through normal channels, but I'm pushing 40 and I'm trying to do this. Mm-hmm. So thank God I had done what I had done. But if I hadn't have been at that level of success, I don't know what would have happened. I don't mm-hmm. think I would have had the option to continue on. But at that point, I was firmly entrenched on a gig. It was part of what was happening. Mm-hmm. And I managed to figure it out.
Now, being a music producer and being in a place where I'm able to hire people rather than being a sideman waiting to be hired, there's nothing that speaks to somebody's integrity more than being a parent. Talking about motherhood being a disqualifier, it's like, when I look at a mom, I'm like, she's going to handle logistics on this immediately. And if she says she's going to be there, she's going to be there, because she's paying somebody to watch her kids. And so she's going to utilize that time. She's going to show up. She's going to be ready. And there's not going to be any wasted time. Whereas, like, whoever 26-year-old dude that's living with eight guys off of Dickerson mm-hmm. Pike, like, you know, like, hopefully he'll show up if he wasn't at Fran's until 4 a.m. And like,
you're so right. And mm-hmm. I have another book up here. This is it. My friend Sarah Lacey, I highly recommend this book. She's a brilliant financial writer. A uterus is a feature, not a bug.
Wow. And I like that.
I just recommend it literature. And it is. It truly is. You know, what's been a real blessing for me and a pathway to putting three kids through college on a musician's salary is... As I was on the road with Marin, I also had this other project that I was working on called Side Piece. And it was all these side men who were women. Mm-hmm. And we were playing 2 or 3 nights a week at the Redneck Riviera on Broadway. And this was when Broadway was a little more tolerable. After mm-hmm. the pandemic, the things have just shifted to the point where it's just not, I can't handle it anymore. But a lot of people thumb their nose at me, like, what are you doing? Like, you're playing with a really successful artist. Why are you downtown on Broadway, you know, slugging it out? It's like, well, first of all, it's very helpful financially. And second of all, I'm really enjoying it. And what it has led to now is, just like you, Aaron, now I can front a band and I'm not mm-hmm. reliant upon getting the call from somebody else of when I'm going to work or not work. And it's completely changed my life with the Tuesday Night Rodeo Club, where we play 3 nights a week, most times way more, because we're doing lots of private events and weddings and corporate stuff. And I get to be in control of my life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for so long, I had struggled with, well, I've got to be on the biggest gig and doing whatever, because that's how people know me and that's my identity. And now it's just shifted to, I'm a joy facilitator.
Yeah.
And that's across the board. If I'm on the big stage, I just got to play Red Rocks with Jason Isbell, you know, last summer. Like, I'm still doing all of that stuff and loving that when it makes sense for my life and my family. And I can have the same tremendous impact and connection with people by doing what we're doing here in this small town. And it's just been such a blessing to know, like, there is life outside of this, and I don't have to be stressed or worried or pin everything on my association with X artist to have a fulfilling and financially solvent career as a musician.
Yeah, I love that so much. One of the many little missions of this podcast, for me at least, is to try to continually dispel this myth that there's only one way to be successful and only one way to be fulfilled. And I think culturally, with mainstream pop world, American Idol, all these contests, we have this broader idea that the only way to be a musician that's worth being is to be famous on big stages. And I think a lot of musicians, we can grow up just not even understanding that that's our belief system, and then going for these things that we think are the answer and realizing, oh, like, there's just as much value, if not more, in playing in these small rooms. And also, these huge big gigs are not a guarantee for life. You can be on one of those gigs and lose it and not get another one. And I think about all of the incredible experiences and people and cultures. Think of a place like New Orleans. And I think it's a really important time to be especially addressing this, given what is happening in our country and with corporations and Live Nation and our fascist government, and like that the little rooms and the streets and the places, they need the investment and the time and people with the skill and the talent to be joy facilitators in those spaces. They're more important.
You're so right. And we had that moment. Like, I'll send you some clips from our Tuesday night gig. And that's actually the genesis of the name of that project, the Tuesday Night Radio Club. We play every Tuesday in this total cowboy bar at this ranch after they have their rodeo. And it's also a nod to the Tuesday Night Music Club, the great Sheryl Crow album, because we're doing covers and we're doing that stuff. So it's like a double entendre. But to be in this room with all these people from all walks of life, and I'm sure some of them happily voted for our fascist government and will continue to do so. But in that moment, we're all on the same page and we're all humans together loving life. And it's just, that's the hope, you know?
Can I share one quick anecdote?
Yes.
Please.
Please.
You had to say yes, of course. And you just reminded me of a life lesson I had in my second year of college. I ended up in Lake Charles, Louisiana at McNeese State University, my dad's alma mater.
Which is the only reason you got in, because you had been kicked out of high school, you and Lucinda Williams.
No, that was my first year of college with Loyola. But yes, I did go to high school with Lucinda Williams, my brother and I. And
participated in a demonstration.
And my wife was, and we go back a long way, so...
But
there was
why
a
were
lot
you
of
kicked out?
Because we were demonstrating. We joined a black student demonstration.
Yes.
And anyway, the 60s were rough.
But he was working to effect change, and he and Lucinda got booted from high school, and he managed to get his GED, and his dad helped him.
No, I did not get my GED.
How did you go to college?
My dad pulled out his checkbook. The admissions officer at Loyola, this priest at Loyola University, I mean, at this point, I had probably done 150 hits of acid or more. I had a bad trip on my brain, was gone. My dad said, son, maybe you ought to try to get into college. And since you dropped out of high school, maybe they'll. And I did well on the ACT by some miracle, because a friend of mine, a woman I ended up living with for a long time, but at the time we hadn't been in a relationship, said, Cranston, you want some of this? She gave me a hit of Speed, so I aced the ACT test.
This is all great advice, kids.
Yeah, this is for the little ones. And so I got into this university with no high school diploma, because my dad and I are in the admissions office. And the guy says, well, what high school did you graduate? Well, I didn't exactly finish. Well, I don't really see how we can accept you here at Loyola. My dad pulls out his checkbook. Let me see if we can make an allowance. So got into my first year of college at Loyola. And then my dad realized that I was pretty much a goner at that point from the 60s. So he put me into his alma mater in Lake Charles, Louisiana, where my grandparents lived, and we spent a lot of time there. So now I'm in this, let's just say, it is a redneck college. They couldn't pronounce the name Cranston, so I said, just call me Clem, which became a four-syllable name. Kalayama.
Kalayama. So, we both go by Clem. I will very quickly interject. So at the gig, at the Tuesday Night Radio Club gig on Tuesday, after the show, I was trying to get people to airdrop footage. I said, just look for Clem's phone. Well, your phone is also Clem's phone.
Oops.
So people were sending all the airdrop. They're like, it's not working. It's not. You said Clem's phone. Like, let me see that. God damn it.
Yes.
Anyway, we both go by Kalayam.
Kalayam.
What was the valuable?
Well, the story is there were a lot of highly bigoted cowboy types in Lake Charles. Serious. And this was 1970, so you can imagine. I mean, it's not all over, but... So I'm this scroungy, recovering hippie weirdo. They would have bands come to McNeese to perform. I saw Canned Heat, who just killed. They were a great guitar player. Henry Vestine was playing that night. Anyway, they had Kenny Rogers next. But anyway, they had the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
I never heard this story. I opened for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band with Holly Williams.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They're really sweet.
So they put on this show. And at the time, I mean, the only song I knew by them was Mr. Bojangles. Wasn't on the top of my playlist, but it was fine. They put on a show that just destroyed. Every one of them played every instrument. They'd switch.
Mm-hmm.
They're killing it. And all of a sudden, I see this cowboy dude who was just a vehement racist. He sees me and he jumps up and throws his arms around me. And I'm about to start crying, but the power of music just, it changed him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like racism, none of that crap matters when your soul wakes up. And just to see this guy be transformed, it just hit me like a lightning bolt. It's like, wow. And that's something I already knew about music from listening to Hendrix and Cream, Jefferson Airplane, The Dead. Could go on and on among many others, but I did go into the hippie thing pretty heavily, to put it mildly. But
when you talk about the Beatles, you know, one thing you said about the Beatles is that they were writing songs about love.
Yes, they were not embarrassed about love. No. It didn't have to be all this angry angst stuff.
No.
Yeah.
You know, they had some of that too, but music to me had the power to lift open your heart and your spirit, you know, and I had some enhanced experiences where I'm listening to Cream live recordings and I'll never be the same. I mean, my brother and I realized that Cream was making this stuff up. We didn't know what improvisation was. We put on the second album of Wheels of Fire. We dropped the LSD. And then all of a sudden we are listening and we both got hit at the same, it was like a lightning bolt. They're making this up. Because I thought you had to learn every note. All I ever did was try to learn like George Harrison's solo on the one about the hole in the roof.
Fixing a hole.
Yeah. It's a great guitar, so it probably really wasn't even George. So, I mean, I had musical experiences that just changed my whole life, you know? And so when I had children, I didn't promote my approach exactly, but I knew what mattered to me. You all just instinctively loved music.
Yeah.
You know, so I have a great faith in the power of music. It's just not a whimsical thing. It's not background music. And it doesn't matter what genre either. That's another thing. I mean, people are very genre specific. It's like, nah, it's great music and it's not so great music.
Right. You know? And we were having this conversation about what makes it great and what makes it not so great. And it's love and heart.
Absolutely.
And authenticity. Mm-hmm. And to your point about what's going on with AI, that's getting wiped out.
Yeah.
And the hope is that in those small rooms, in those spaces, on the streets, you can't manufacture that. It's just coming from the heart.
Yes. Yeah. AI, that's not the same thing.
No.
That reminds me, speaking of AI, there was some comments to a band that a friend of mine sent me a link to. Have you all heard of these two guys from Canada called Engine de Poitrine? Mm-mm. It's a duo. Yeah. One of them's playing guitar and a bass, and he's got microtonal frets on both of them and a drummer. And it's the craziest thing I've seen, and it's incredibly complex. And one of the comments was, watch out, AI. You know, it's like, you can't do this.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, my God.
I'm going to spell it for you because you all got to look these people up. A-N-G-I-N-E.
Okay.
And then D, which is D-E. And then P-O-I-T-R-I-N-E. You got to look them up.
Thank you.
One comment that I love says, the weird part starts at 0.00. Yep, you got that right.
Oh, my God.
But it renewed my hope in music because it's like, AI cannot do this. And if y'all tell me that AI actually did it, I'll be very angry.
No, yeah. I hope not.
But we've probably run out of time here.
We have, only because I have to go pick up our daughter from school. You guys are like a comedy act that I have not laughed
my
this hard.
Hurt.
Yeah. So this has been such a just reaffirming, enlightening. I feel like we could talk for 10 hours and I really want to hang out with you guys.
Yeah, this was wonderful and I'm honored that you invited me to do this with you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My favorite thing is that, like, beyond just the fact that this is going to be a podcast episode, is that this is recorded forever.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I've been, Michaela, I'll tell you, I've been doing that now on this trip. I just tell them, like, I'm sorry, I have to roll tape on this. And I just set up the camera and we just talk because this is our life. And
it is.
We gotta record it for posterity and for the future.
Well, thank you for indulging us. And Danny, thanks for not shoving me away from the phone.
We got close. We got real close.
I felt it.
Go ahead and pick up this book. Very, very insightful. But yeah, we survived.
Oh, my God.
Another 22 hours.
Okay, well, this was really fun.
Thank you so much. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys. Have fun getting those kiddos, and we'll talk soon.
Definitely.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. Have a good one.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.